Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Republican John Boehner was sworn in as the nation's 61st Speaker of the House. President Obama tapped former Clinton-era officials to fill top vacancies at the White House, and the Labor Department reported employers added 103,000 jobs in December, lowering the unemployment rate to 9.4%. Joining me for the first Friday News Roundup of the new year, NPR's David Wilna, Susan Page of USA Today, and Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal. We'll welcome your calls a little later in the program. Join us on 800-433-8850. In the meantime, you can send us your emails, join us on Facebook, or send us a tweet. Good morning and Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Is the job market finally beginning to improve, Susan?
It's so painful to see this report this morning. On the one hand, there's good news. Unemployment rate down to 9.4%. That's the lowest in close to 2 years. And people really look at the unemployment rate. That's going to make Americans feel a little better. But then you look at the number of new jobs created, 103,000 net new jobs. That's below the number of new jobs that need to be created just to keep the unemployment rate steady, given the growth in the U.S. population. We need much stronger job growth to really bring that unemployment number down to a more acceptable level. What this reflects in part is that people have gotten discouraged, dropped out, stopped looking for work, and that's why they're no longer counted as jobless.
Naftali.
Well, still, it's hard to see as anything other than good news that the unemployment is down to a relatively low rate. And I think this continues to tell a story that we've seen over the past few months, which is that things are moving in the right direction, but it's sort of a halting, somewhat struggling progress. And all this, of course, in addition to being important to workers, it has political implications, because if the economy continues a steady, albeit slow, increase over the next 2 years, then the 2012 elections may be fought in a very different political climate than the last ones were.
David, well, no.
I think one thing that this also reflects is that people are eligible for unemployment benefits only up to 99 weeks. And we are just past 2 years past the 99 weeks since the economy really collapsed. And I think one factor driving down the unemployment rate is simply that there are more people who are ineligible now for unemployment benefits. So it's not all good news. As Susan said, this isn't even enough to keep up with the growing job market, this 103,000 job increase. And over the last 3 months, it's only been enough to keep up with increase.
It's such a sign of the times that you could say people are eligible for unemployment only for 99 weeks.
Right.
Think about that, 99
right.
weeks of unemployment, but we see millions of Americans getting past that terrible benchmark.
So Ben Bernanke is speaking on Capitol Hill this morning. It sounds as though he is defending his decision to put more money into the economy.
Yeah, that was, of course, a fairly controversial decision. And he's been on the defensive about it. But, of course, now there's a very different landscape on Capitol Hill than there was really just a week ago. And people really in both parties, but perhaps more in the Republican Party, have been very critical and really asking about what the Fed is doing. I think a lot of economists would tend to feel that some of their moves, like the quantitative easing that you're talking about, made a certain amount of sense, but there are people who are very suspicious of this relatively secretive agency. I mean, one of the interesting things that I think we've seen about the job numbers, which always can be interpreted in so many different ways, is the Republicans today are saying unemployment continues to hover near 9%, and Democrats are saying unemployment dropped by almost a full 0.5%. And to me, that sort of exemplifies the fact that this is a, it's sort of a rocky, shaky recovery, albeit one that seems to be moving in the right direction.
Well, I think the reactions from the two top leaders from the two parties in Congress today gives you a sense of that. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid immediately praised the Obama administration for bringing that number down. Speaker of the House John Boehner immediately put out a release saying that this shows why we have to cut spending now. In a sense, it's puzzling why if the unemployment rate drops, that means spending should be cut, but that's been the mantra of Republicans, and he's sticking to it.
David Weltner of NPR and of Taliban, David of the Wall Street Journal, Susan Page of USA Today. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Well, let's ease into the new Congress. The newly installed Majority Leader John Boehner saying hard work, tough decisions ahead. But yesterday, Republicans started with a whole bunch of brand new rules. David Weltner, what are these about?
These are rules that make it easier for Republicans to do what they want to do in the House. For one thing, they pass a rule that says that the chairman of the Budget Committee can unilaterally set the spending limits for the different subcommittees of the Appropriations Committee. And this is something that is normally done by passing a budget. And they say, well, we don't have a budget, so we're going to let one person, Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, set those limits. It doesn't seem to be in step with the kind of accountability that they say is going to be a hallmark of this House.
Only accountability, but working in concert with Democrats.
That's true. Another thing that they said was that they would have hearings on all major legislation before it's taken up in the House. One of the first things that they've done this week is to bring up a major piece of legislation, a repeal of the entire health care law, and there's not been a single hearing for that. And they say, well, that's because the committees haven't been put together yet. Well, why not wait a little bit to let the committees come together? Well, they say, we made a promise and we want to show that we're keeping it. But in doing so, I think they're having to kind of trample on some of these new rules that they've just passed. For example, one of them is that every law should have some, or every bill should have some provision showing what the constitutional authority of Congress is to pass that bill. This repeal of the health care law has no such provision.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's happening is within 24 hours, the two parties are immediately reversing roles. You know, so the majority Republicans are defending their policies, and the Democrats are sitting back and throwing bombs, which is what the Republicans have been doing for the past 2 years. But the health care bill really was a striking part of all this. The Republicans passed rules that said that, any bill has to be paid for, which is something that the Democrats did too, but they made these big exceptions. One of them is tax cuts don't have to be paid for, and the other is that the repeal of the health care bill, which according to the Congressional Budget Office would cost the Treasury quite a bit of money, that doesn't have to be paid for either. So the Democrats sort of had a field day yesterday, lobbing those criticisms at the Republicans, and the Republicans, after 2 years of being on the attack, found themselves on the defensive.
You know, I thought there were a couple of bumps yesterday. I mean, the first day when the new Republican House was sworn in was a pretty good day. They got a chance to make their case. It's always, kind of an emotional thing, that day of everyone getting sworn in and the families being there and so on. But yesterday, they had a ton of trouble. And you mentioned the health care rule that they passed. This is, of course, something they're going to vote on next Wednesday, and they'll make a big deal about it, fulfilling a promise to a lot of those Tea Party supporters. But it turns out two members of Congress, two Republicans, weren't on the floor for the swearing in. One of them, a very senior member, Pete Sessions from Texas. Then they went ahead and voted on the rule in the Rules Committee yesterday, and it's caused questions about whether they have to do it all over again, even perhaps delaying the health care vote because they were not constitutionally sanctioned to exercise their votes as members of Congress.
This on the day when they actually read the Constitution on the floor of the House for the
with
first time in the history of the House. An edited version of it. There were portions of the Constitution that are generally seen as regrettable now that were excised from this reading. It turns out that the House of Representatives does not have an official version of the Constitution even to refer to, this institution that is supposedly based on the Constitution. And there were objections, especially Jesse Jackson Jr. from Illinois said that he thought that taking out the parts that referred to black slaves as three-fifths of a person and that they couldn't cross state lines for refuge, those parts should remain as a reminder. And I think a reminder of the fallibility of the Founding Fathers, something that these sort of fundamentalist constitutional advocates in the Tea Party don't seem to want to acknowledge.
You know, a lot of Democrats, I think, saw that reading the Constitution as a real stunt. But there was a moment which I thought was beautiful, which was when John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia and a hero of the civil rights movement, read the 13th Amendment, which ended slavery in this country. That was a moment.
Now, what about the CBO estimate on the health care reform bill, and John Boehner saying, well, they can have their opinion, but that doesn't make it true.
Yeah, the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, has estimated that a repeal would cost $230 billion to the U.S. Treasury over the first 10 years.
And actually,
a repeal would cost that to the Treasury, and actually considerably more in the next 10 years.
Now, why would that be? Explain that
well,
to me.
Well, there are elements of the—this is actually consistent with what they were saying when the health care bill was passed, and they said that it would add money to the Treasury. And that's for a lot of reasons. There are taxes imposed on various large industries that are about to get a huge market share increase, pharmaceutical manufacturers, for example. And so in return, and many of them were on board with this, they were going to pay a certain amount to the U.S. Treasury. But there's also taxes that have to do with people who choose not to get health insurance. They pay taxes as well. So for these reasons, the health care bill was going to reduce the deficit. The Republicans argue that they were given all kinds of faulty assumptions and that that's a myth and that nobody in their right mind would think that this huge bill would actually save money for the Treasury. But the Democrats point to these Congressional Budget Office scores, and it's become a pretty big point of contention. And, you know, as I say, suddenly it's the Republicans who are having to defend everything they do, who are having to defend against accusations of inconsistency. And it's the Democrats. I mean, to me, they almost seem to be enjoying it. Of course, we all know they'd rather be in the majority, but there's something about not having responsibility for doing anything, only having to criticize, that seems to be enjoyable.
Yeah, one of the biggest savings that's projected is in Medicare spending, especially cutting back on Medicare Advantage. And Republicans say that simply is not going to happen. Politically, that's not possible. So Boehner's contention is sort of that, well, yes, I agree that if we're going to add to the costs, we have to compensate for it. But I don't think those costs are going to be there. Still, they passed a rule that exempted this from paying for
all
of this.
David Wiltner, congressional correspondent for NPR. And welcome back to the first Friday News Roundup of 2011 with Susan Page of USA Today, David Wiltner of NPR, Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal. One question I should have asked, Susan, when you said Pete Sessions was not where he should have been yesterday. Where was he?
He was at the Capitol Visitor Center with a freshman member of Congress, Mike Fitzpatrick. There was an event for Congressman Fitzpatrick's supporters. Some people called it a fundraiser. He said there wasn't a charge to go there. But I think they lost track of time. And so when they saw the swearing-in going on a TV monitor, they stood up, raised their hands, took the oath of office. But, of course, it's sort of like when the news says something you don't like or you're watching Jon Stewart and you shout back. I don't think it counts.
Yeah, so there was this whole thing that happened in the Rules Committee where they went through this fairly elaborate setting of the rule for the vote on repealing the health care law. And then it turned out, I think some local newspaper actually in Pennsylvania figured out, or maybe it was Texas, that these guys hadn't been sworn in. And that required an abrupt adjournment of the Rules Committee.
Oh, my goodness.
They had to go back and rethink it. And they're still trying to work it out. I mean, they're still hoping to work out a deal where things the Rules Committee did still count.
Well, they need unanimous consent of the Democrats to do that. And, you know, given relations, the state of relations between Republicans and Democrats in the House. I just wonder if Nancy Pelosi will go along with that.
Yeah.
I mean, she could either choose to show it as a sign of bipartisanship or as a sign to stick it to the Republicans. But it is, you know, as Susan was saying earlier, there have been a series of glitches, and maybe that's to be expected in the opening days of a Congress. But I think the Republicans are finding that it's, you know, there's a lot of problems that come fairly quickly when you're in the majority.
David.
Yeah. And even before this came to light yesterday, Senate Democratic leaders held a news conference attacking House Republicans for blowing what they said was a $1.3 trillion hole in the deficit. And they were asked at this news conference, well, what are your plans for this next Congress? And Charles Schumer of New York, who's in charge of the messaging for the Senate Democrats, said, well, we'll get to that later. We want to just focus right now on the House. And really, I think they're having a good time just standing and watching how House Republicans are having to answer all these questions.
Well, the American people are not going to be very happy if this kind of foolishness continues. Let me ask you about something that has been talked about somewhat. Is it true that there is going to be a 60% increase in health insurance costs for the state of California, Neftali?
Well, apparently, Blue Cross of California has requested this sort of a insurance, or sort of notified the state that this kind of an insurance increase is going to happen. It's actually happening in a lot of states across the country, although California's is the biggest one that I've heard of so far.
60%?
Yeah, they're close to that. I think it's not quite 60%, but close to that. There are states, actually, where the commissioner of insurance can turn down an insurance company's request. I'm not sure that's the case in California, but this has immediately prompted a debate where people who are in favor of the health care bill are saying, this is why we need health care reform. And opponents are saying, it's because you passed the health care reform that insurance rates are going up. And that prompted, actually, the head of this California insurance company to issue a letter saying, well, it really wasn't because of health care reform. This is something that we were going to do because of trends in the market in any case. But it's going to be an interesting driver of the debate because people are seeing their premiums skyrocket in a fairly dramatic way.
Who in the world can afford to pay that kind?
Well, I was talking with Senator Jay Rockefeller, the chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, yesterday about this, about Anthem's request for an increase in fees. And he said, that's fine. They can ask for this increase. But you know what? We have a new law that says insurance companies have to spend 85% of what they take in on actual benefits for people. And he said, well, you know, that's going to mean they're going to have to provide a lot more benefits. But in terms of a competitive marketplace, they're not going to be viable if they keep paying out that much to their customers.
And that's a rule. I think it's an 80% rule, isn't it? That the insurance companies have to pay 80% of their premiums back to customers, either in services or in wellness programs or so on. That's a provision of the law that went into effect 7 days ago on January 1st, along with some other provisions that will be pretty popular. And one of the interesting things you're seeing now is Democrats trying to make the case that they failed to make in the past 2 years, which is that this health care bill is a good deal. We had a poll in the paper this morning, a new Gallup poll that came back. Only 40% of Americans think the health care law should stand. 4 out of 10 Americans, I mean 6 out of 10 Americans, don't feel that way about a law that was enacted in March. There's really a task that remains to be done by the White House and congressional Democrats.
David.
But I think that response has to be nuanced a little bit because there are people who don't want it to stand because they want it to go a lot farther than it goes. Those who are opposed to it philosophically, I think, tend to be about 35% to 40% of the people responding. But you have 15% to 20% who think that there should have been a public option.
David, I would disagree with you. The question in the poll was, should we repeal the law or not? Hmm. And only 40% said not.
I see.
So whether they think the law didn't go far enough or went too far, they think the law ought to be repealed, 46%, not all of them. Some people didn't have an opinion. So this is a huge challenge, I think, going ahead.
And Democrats really are seeing this moment when Republicans are going to go to the floor on Wednesday with a repeal bill as an attempt to relitigate, in a sense, and re-argue this argument that many of them feel they lost last year.
Now, someone, Barbara from Medford, Oregon, focusing once again on the Congress, says Congressman Issa has already said he wants to investigate corruption in the Obama government. She wants to know, how much is this going to cost American taxpayers?
Well, it's obviously hard to quantify that exactly. Under the Clinton administration, there was the hiring of a lot of lawyers in the White House, to respond to congressional investigations and inquiries. What ISA has said is that he's not going to undertake those kinds of investigations, but rather more substantive ones that have to do with everything from Afghanistan to the FDA to other kinds of, legislative policy issues.
How can you investigate the nation's president? How can you say each of these policies is flawed and therefore we're going to undertake this investigation? I don't get it.
Well, there's this committee, the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. It's been traditionally a place where there are these real attack dog type members of Congress, whether it's Henry Waxman or Dan Burton or now Daryl Issa, and they see it as their job to keep the administration honest. It is a remarkably wide ranging committee in that almost anything in the government seems to be under their jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And Daryl Issa has sent very clear signals that he intends to use that power.
You know, Diane, you've been taking questions off Twitter for some time, and I'm a big fan of Twitter myself. And Daryl Issa has changed his Twitter photo that goes on with each feed. I saw it yesterday. I don't know if he changed it earlier. And it shows him as a cartoon figure wearing a big policeman's hat. And it says, the nation's watchdog. So that's how he is seeing himself going forward.
As opposed to the nation's attack dog. But actually, the House yesterday voted to cut the budget of all committees and all members of the House by 5%. So if they've got ambitions to carry out these big investigations, they're going to find that they're not going to have that much wherewithal to actually carry them out.
All right. Let's talk about these latest changes at the White House for President Obama's top advisors. Wednesday, we heard that Robert Gibbs is leaving in February, and Thursday, President Obama tapped Commerce Secretary William Daley as his permanent chief of staff, and today he's expected to name Gene Sperling as head of the National Economic Council. So, Susan, what do all these changes indicate?
I think that administrations, presidential terms have chapters. I think we are entering a new and different chapter from the first 2 years of the Obama administration. And Bill Daley's taking over the role of chief of staff reflects that. It means, number one, that the president is looking for a lot more outreach to the business community. Bill Daley is in some ways a Paul. He certainly comes from one of the nation's top political families, the Daleys of Chicago. But he's been in banking. He was the Commerce Secretary. He has great ties to the business community. That's been a huge weakness for this White House. They're going to have to do a lot more with Republicans. Things will not happen. Their programs, they're on defense on some things. They want some things to get done. They need to have better relations with Republicans in Congress than they have before. And you're going to see a different agenda, I think, too. We've had 2 years of huge pieces of legislation being enacted. Now we're going to have 2 years of trying to defend them from being repealed, from trying to implement them, and trying to set up the case for the president's reelection campaign in 2020.
Liberal Democrats may not be too happy with the choice of Daley or sympathetic with the idea that the president hasn't been close enough to the business community.
Yeah, and we saw that already. The minute that Bill Daley's appointment was announced, there was some negative reaction from liberal groups. There was remarkably positive reaction from conservative and business groups. Tom Donohue, the head of the Chamber of Commerce, as well as Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, neither of whom loved to give compliments to the White House, were effusive in their praise of Bill Daley. I think that alone has made liberal groups suspicious. But there's another element to what's happening here. It's not only, I think, that President Obama is confronting a very different political landscape. He's also getting ready for reelection. And it may seem pretty early for that, but that's how administrations work. And having a guy like Robert Gibbs and a guy like David Axelrod outside the White House, where they're a little bit freer, not only to attack Republicans, but also to do things like organize and raise money and do various things that you can't do when you're observing the proprieties of being inside the White House, I think is part of laying the groundwork for the reelection campaign.
I agree with Susan that we are kind of going into a new chapter right now. The first 2 years were really the legislative chapter of bulldozing these big bills through with gigantic majorities in both chambers. Those are gone now. And I think we see the White House turning to the things that it knows need to get done, but need bipartisan support, things such as overhauling the tax code, for example, or looking at entitlement reform, even such things as getting a trade deal with South Korea through. That's something that needs bipartisan support. Those are the kinds of things I think that the White House is going to be focusing on, and that shores up its credibility also both with the business community and also with independents, something that it really needs going into 2012.
And, you know, the first big test we may see about whether these two sides can get together will come with the debate over raising the debt ceiling, which could come in March. You know, we had a warning this week from the Treasury Secretary that we may hit the debt ceiling by the end of March. That will be a real test of the Republican leadership in the House, their ability to muster the troops to support a debt ceiling. The White House, it will focus the debate on spending, which is going to be perhaps the biggest and most fundamental debate we'll have this year.
And it has been termed catastrophic if that debt ceiling is not raised. And yet you've already had some Republicans say, not going to do it.
Well, what happened is that the idea of raising the debt ceiling is a very powerful symbol. And during the last campaign, quite a few Republicans who won ran in part by trashing Democratic incumbents for voting to raise the debt ceiling last time around. So now they're not exactly in a position where they can turn around and vote to raise the debt ceiling. On the other hand, if the debt ceiling isn't raised, it would have very negative impacts.
Well,
the government probably wouldn't default right away, which is what people say, because they can move things around. But there's no question that the government's creditworthiness and trustworthiness, would plummet. And that would affect interest rates. It would affect all kinds of things. Nobody really wants to see that happen, nor, in my opinion, will permit it to happen.
But
so the dynamic you have right now is Republicans trying to exact significant spending cuts in exchange for their vote to raise the debt ceiling. And that's what you're going to see play out in the next
few
months.
But you're going to see brinkmanship over this. And when you have that kind of fight, you don't really know whether you're going to end up going off the side of the cliff or not.
And also, I think key is how much they're going to raise the debt limit by, because Republicans would prefer to do it in small increments, thus increasing their leverage and their ability to keep going back and asking for more spending cuts.
David Wilne of NPR, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Presidential Commission investigating the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill released a summary of the findings this week, and that suggested that there was blame all around Naftali.
It did, but it also did kind of focus it on the managers at BP. I mean, you know, there's a sense in there that there was a single overarching failure, a failure of management. And by that, they mean corporate management, and they mean primarily BP's management. But to me, one of the real interesting things in that preliminary report was that they describe it as a systemic problem, that if it's not corrected, there will be other problems. Because one of the big debates ever since the spill has been, was this an aberration, or is it something that's system-wide in terms of the way we do oil drilling offshore? And, you know, there was a hearing a few months ago where all the CEOs of other oil companies came and basically said, hey, this was BP's problem. It was the way they did it. It would never happen to us. And this report sort of suggests otherwise. It suggests that there are broad problems and big changes that need to be made.
So what does that indicate about the president allowing more offshore drilling until those kinds of systemic problems are corrected?
Well, logically, he wouldn't do it.
Right.
And that seems to be a fairly strong policy implication of all this. Interestingly, Mary Landrieu, who is a senator from Louisiana and one of the big proponents of offshore drilling because of the state she comes from, sort of tried to frame this as showing why we should lift the moratorium. But I wasn't quite understanding what her case was. And I think, you'll see a strong push from people who feel like we need big changes before lifting the moratorium, citing this report in making their argument.
You know, it's certainly true that the companies, BP, Transocean, Halliburton, all got hammered in this report, or got really slammed in this report for taking shortcuts that made this accident possible. But the federal government got a lot of criticism, too, for it was a failure also of the oversight role of the government to prevent the companies from making shortcuts that allowed this spill and accident to happen.
I want to talk about red ink at the Pentagon and the cutting that Defense Secretary Gates announced of, what, $78 billion. I had heard earlier in the week it was going to be $100 billion. What happened there?
Well, there's some confusion about this because of what Gates said last August, which was that he was going to seek to cut spending at the Pentagon by $100 billion over the next 5 years, although he would take that savings and then apply it to new programs in the Pentagon. It was going to be a net result that spending would stay at the same levels. Then the White House decided that there really have to be real cuts. They wanted about $150 billion in cuts. And in the end, Gates prevailed on getting about half that amount over the next 5 years. And this is not to say that defense spending is going to diminish by $78 billion over the next year. This is simply reducing the projected increases in spending by $78 billion.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing here is the collision of two sort of longer-term trends. Ever since 9/11, there's been a buildup of the national security state. There's no question about it. The military has increased. On the other hand, we're in a really tough financial time. And so far, the military has to some degree been spared. And I think this is a sign that that's not going to be the case anymore. I mean, like David says, really what we're going to see is a leveling off of defense spending. It's not like we're going to see some huge cuts. But Republicans are in a very interesting position here, because they are very strong proponents of national security and of the military. They're also strong proponents of fiscal austerity. And this is a situation where those two are arguably in conflict. And you're seeing more and more Republicans like Eric Cantor, like Mitch McConnell saying, well, you know, everything's on the table. The military can't be spared. And I think one reason for that is if you're talking about cutting huge percentages from the budget, you can't exempt the military.
Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, David Wilton of NPR, Susan Page of USA Today. When we come back, time to open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care. On the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The Pentagon plans to send an additional 1,400 Marines to Afghanistan. The Ivory Coast presidential election remains unresolved. And a governor in Pakistan is assassinated. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Here's our first message from Facebook. Chris says, John Boehner had the opportunity yesterday to end unequivocally the birther conspiracy for his caucus for the next 2 years. Instead, he said, it's not up to me to tell them what to think. He could have said they were wrong. He wasn't going to waste any of Congress or the nation's time with legislation. He chose not to, and that's disappointing. And I watched this interview between him and Bryant Williams. Susan.
You know, this came up yesterday in the reading of the Constitution. Congressman Frank Pallone from New Jersey was reading the provision of the Constitution that establishes the requirements for people who want to run for president. And when he talked about having to be native born, a woman in the gallery said, except Obama, except Obama, and was quickly escorted out. But This is an issue that doesn't seem to be able to go, doesn't seem to be going away. One interesting thing is the new governor of Hawaii, who knew Obama's parents when the future president was born, says that he is going to make an effort to open up additional records in Hawaii to settle once and for all the issue of where President Obama was born.
Although I wonder if that would help. I mean, it seems like a lot of this is based not so much on a rational examination of documents as on some need to believe that Obama is something foreign and different. And I think, you know, among other things, it shows the difficult road the Republicans are going to have, the tension they're going to have with some of their most, fierce Tea Party supporters, and how you sort of keep those. And that, I mean, it was one thing to do it when they were in the minority, but now that they actually run part of government, I think that's going to be a tension that they're really going to have to deal with.
And I think the kowtowing to the Tea Party that we've seen in the first days of the 112th Congress, the reading of the Constitution, the move to repeal the health care law, this is in a House where only 35 of the 242 Republicans were elected with explicit Tea Party backing. So in Congress, they're actually a tiny minority, and yet they seem to have quite a sway over the leadership at this point.
But even Republicans who weren't elected with Tea Party support, some of them worry about Tea Party challengers in their primaries next time around. We certainly saw the Tea Party was able to oust some long-term members of Congress last year by running against them in primaries. So their influence is more extensive than their numbers might indicate.
All right, let's go to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Thomas.
Yes, hello. Maybe you covered this before, and I do support the health care plan, but how would the repeal of it add to our deficit?
Yeah, we did talk a little about that before. Go ahead, Naftali, if you could briefly reiterate.
Sure. Well, as part of the health care plan, there were certain costs imposed on industries that were participating that would bring money into the Treasury. And also, as David pointed out, there were certain savings that were to be had in the Medicare program. So passage of the health care bill was found by the Congressional Budget Office to bring money into the Treasury, and its repeal would therefore cost the Treasury money.
All right. Jim in Michigan wants to add to the conversation. How do you pronounce your town, Jim?
It's actually pronounced Okemos.
Okay, I got it. Go right ahead.
Okay, more on the health care. I guess I'm pulling over because I don't want to get in trouble with Diane.
Good.
Susan and David were talking earlier about statistics and polls related to health care. And I guess I'm an employer. I have health care for my employees. And it is so incredibly complex that for me, to conduct a poll where you're asking someone whether they think it should be repealed or not touched is silly, when these people would have absolutely no idea. You know, getting through an explanation of benefit statement is tricky enough, let alone trying to understand what happens now, what's happening in 2014. I wish the Democrats would get someone, some great communicator, to stand up, to spend the time with a big chalkboard and say, okay, here's the status quo. Let's look at some examples. Here's a 50-year-old guy. He's in good health. He goes to the gym every day. He gets, you know, this happens. Take six examples, the status quo versus what this bill is going to do. Try and make it simple and digestible so people can, you know, that we'll stop wasting time trying to go back, that the Republicans are making so many silly arguments about why this should go away. Just blow it out of the water.
You know, Jim, perhaps Bill Daley will be on the phone with you shortly to offer you a job on the White House staff, because, of course, the White House congressional Democrats need to do that if they believe the health care bill makes sense, serves people, is going to be to the benefit of Americans. They need to explain to Americans why that's the case.
All right. To Paducah, Kentucky. Hi, Nathan.
Hello. Thank you. I just had a quick comment or question. It goes back to the earlier part of the program about the two gentlemen who didn't show up for work. It really upsets me for some reason. It may not be as important as the other things, but I'm wondering if there are any repercussions for them besides redoing the votes, wasting more time and taxpayer money. Does anything happen to those two people?
Yeah, talk about a waste of taxpayer money, Naftali.
Well, I think it's unlikely. I mean, nobody's talking about that. They presumably should have been in the chamber during the swearing in and lost track of time and didn't make it. All the talk right now has been about how do we remedy, if we need to remedy, some of the votes that the Rules Committee took. Maybe they should be reprimanded in some way, but I don't think that's where things
are
headed.
You doubt it, all right?
I do think it's kind of embarrassing for them.
That's true. Especially one of them was a fairly senior member of Congress,
totally.
Pete Sessions. He was the head, and he continues to be the head, of the Republican House campaign arm.
Somebody got his calendar mixed up, maybe. Let's go to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Michael.
Hello, Diane. Yes, I would like to just take a minute. You know, Darrell Issa has been on TV lately talking about the administration being corrupt and so on and so forth, but I don't hear anybody in the media taking time to take a look at Darrell Issa. You know, he's been accused and convicted of car theft in the past, illegal gun possession, insurance fraud. He spent $1.7 million of his own money to recall Gray Davis out of California. And he has a checkered past, but I don't hear anybody in the press going back to take a look at this guy and say, hey, you know, who was he to be throwing stones at the president when he has his own issues?
Naftali.
Well, I mean, it is true that, I mean, some Democrats have pointed out that Darrell Issa, you know, he ran this company that was, I think they helped invent LoJack or something like that, the car alarm system. And it's true, he was very involved in the recall of Governor Davis. I have a feeling it's not going to be too long before Democrats do train their sights on him, because he's made very strong statements about this being one of the most corrupt administrations. And that kind of thing makes you a target. And my guess is it won't be long now before we see some of that.
And to South Bend, Indiana. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning. My comment relates to the Congressional Budget Office and its analysis of costs of bills, et cetera, and the fact that the Congressional Budget Office basically takes whatever assumptions it is given by Congress and does the analysis. So they're currently working on the assumptions that were delivered by the Democratic Congress, and there was a whole bunch of moving of items forward and back and assumptions made which can never be met, such as cutting Medicare by $500 billion. So to rely upon their $200+ billion cost estimate is, to me, it doesn't make sense. In fact, one of the things that Congress should do is take a look at the Congressional Budget Office and perhaps bring their analysis up to the 21st century.
Yeah, that's been a debate that's been going on for some time. For example, the Bush-era tax cuts that just got extended, when the CBO was making its projections for the coming years, it was assuming that those tax cuts would not be extended. And so the budgets look very different in terms of the kinds of deficits that the government would be running. And, of course, they're going to be running greater deficits because those tax cuts were extended. And it does call into question about what should the CBO realistically be considering. Now, one thing is that the CBO does consult a range of opinions on what the impact of legislation might be, and it usually settles on sort of the middle opinion. So there is some leeway that they have in their estimates.
Here's an email from Heather in Belmont, North Carolina. Please ask Susan Page if she knows the results of poll questions that specifically address particular components of health care. Because of the misnomer government-controlled health care, which Republicans have used, many say they want health care repealed. But when asked if they want coverage for pre-existing conditions, coverage of children up to 26, Americans are hugely supportive.
That is certainly true. And the Kaiser Foundation, which is a nonprofit foundation, has done a lot of polling in this area. They've got a website that's interesting to look at. It certainly shows that some provisions of the health care bill are very popular. But some of the provisions that make it possible to put together this complicated puzzle that is health care reform are not popular. For instance, the mandate that all Americans, or virtually all Americans, buy health insurance or have health insurance. It's a key provision. It's kind of the thing about which everything else stems. There's a lot of suspicion about that. And we've talked about the effort to repeal the health care law in Congress. There's also 24 lawsuits in federal court attacking the health care law on the constitutionality of that individual mandate. That is something that almost certainly will end up being decided by the Supreme Court.
Here's an email from Eric in Cleveland who says, will the Senate reform the filibuster? David.
Well, the Senate right now is in the process of looking at ways to, not necessarily to change the filibuster by itself, in which you need to get 60 votes to get past this extended debate. They're looking really at more changing the circumstances in which the filibuster can be used. On the motion to proceed, which means trying to bring up a bill on the floor, Democrats are saying this should not be something that could be stopped by a filibuster. And in fact, there is a Senate rule that allows the majority leader to bring up something in the first 2 hours of business, and it can't be stopped by a filibuster, but Majority Leader Reid just hasn't done that. But I think Republicans recognize that if they don't reach some kind of a deal with Democrats, Democrats could resort when they come back in session on January 25th, and it will still be the first legislative day because they're only in recess, they haven't adjourned, that they could, with only 51 votes, change the rules. I think there are Democrats who are leery of doing that just because it could lead to a lot of fratricide in the Senate if they did so.
And don't you, hasn't the filibuster in its old sense, hasn't that gone out the window? Doesn't somebody just have to say, we're going to filibuster, but not stand up there and read the telephone book for 9 hours?
It's the threat of a filibuster,
right?
The threat to keep debating. And the problem is that the ways the rules are written, if you have somebody out on the floor arguing against a bill, for example, and saying it should not come to a vote, that person at some point can call for a quorum. And if you don't have at least 50 senators on hand, the session can be suspended. And then when they go back in session, the debate can continue. So what it really does is it makes the majority or those who are defending the legislation that they want to advance, it requires them to stay all night and maybe only one or two of the people who are opposing it.
David, well, of NPR, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's kind of a good summation from Dino in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He says, this is all incredible stuff you all are talking about for the first few days of Congress. Missing the swearing-in, read a redacted version of the Constitution. Really, the strict constructionists edit the Constitution, ignore their new rules right out of the box. It reinforces that Republicans' talking points are a ruse. They simply want power for the sake of having power. I don't agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in fairness, the opening days of a new Congress after a transition of power can be a little bit rocky. And I think that's one of the things that's going on. I think another thing that's going on is you do say certain things when you are running, when you're in the opposition, and then suddenly you have to govern. What John Boehner says about the fact that they're going to push through this health care repeal without amendments is, look, I said I'd have a more open process. I didn't say every single bill would have the most open process possible. And Democrats have not had an open rule for the last two years. So I think they are running into some glitches. I think they're finding, as I said earlier, it's not always so much fun to be in the majority. I think we have to see how the next few months play out to really get a sense of how they're doing.
Susan.
Although your mother always told you only have one chance to make a first impression. Republicans in the House are making their first impression, not on one day, not on one day's flubs, but they don't have 2 years to demonstrate to Americans how they plan to govern.
And here is an attempt at clarification from Anthony. He says only 46% of Americans want the bill repealed, not 6 out of 10.
That's correct. 46% wanted repeal. 40% said it should stand. 14% didn't have an opinion. That's exactly right.
Right. Okay. So that the upshot, he says, is the nation is split with no majority either way.
The nation is split, but you can look at these numbers and figure out why Republicans are proceeding. 8 out of 10 Republicans want the bill repealed. This goes straight to the Republican base. It unifies the Republicans, and it pleases the Tea Party movement.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on what happens next after this vote next Wednesday.
On health care?
Yes, on health care. Forgive me.
Well, I think clearly we know that the Senate is not going to probably even consider this, let alone pass it. And if by some strange chance they did, President Obama would veto any repeal. So I think what happens next is Republicans look for ways to bite off smaller pieces, to either repeal small items of it or to defund small items of it. And that's going to be the big fight over the next few months, for sure.
Now, will that defunding work in effect to undermine the whole the health care bill?
You know, it's definitely a complication because the HHS and states need additional funding to implement big parts of this health care bill. But the administration also has the ability to shift some money around. So it's a complication, but it doesn't necessarily. The answer to your question, no, I don't think it undermines it entirely.
You don't?
I don't. I think, but I think it's one more. What we're going to see, I think, is a year of pitched battles, of relitigation of the fight that we thought was settled when that law was signed in March.
Talk about a waste of taxpayer money. I don't get why Republicans would use, as you said, they've only got 2 years. And as you've said, do they want to waste it on this whole thing?
I think that they are running a huge risk of repeating what Democrats did during the past 2 years, which was focusing on an issue that, people say, this does not really get me a new job. That's why they call their repeal the repeal of the job-killing health care law.
David Wellen of NPR, Susan Page of USA Today, Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal. Happy New Year, everybody.
Same to you.
Happy New Year.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.